The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
It is, and it's a Thursday. Welcome to it. And I'm really excited. We've got a very, very busy show for you today. So if you're expecting, like, the news, stay tuned for after the show. I'll play the extended version of What's News, or you can go to NicoleSandler.com and get yourself today's What's News episode. But we're going to jump right in today because I am really excited about our guest. Oh, and I just lost him. What did I just do here? I'm going to bring in Cory Doctorow is our guest, and I did have him here just a second ago. Hi, Cory. I can hear you, but
Hi.
I set up our shot a moment ago, and for some reason your picture is not there. So let me try to figure out what happened, because I had it a moment ago. But I will bring you in. In the meantime, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
I work alone, so I'm my own producer and everything, engineer. So that's why it's taken me a second, but I will get your...
I have to say that I like being represented as a featureless black void.
You will not be in a moment. I've got you here. I just have to edit the shot. And I'll bring your photo in, your video in just a second. But there you are. You're out in California now, but you're a Canadian, yes?
That's right. I'm a dual Canadian British national, and I moved to Los Angeles from London, and I was born and raised in Toronto.
Oh wow! So you know what? That goes along with just who you are, because I've got your official bio here. Hold on one second. Let me get your picture up here, because I am talking to a black void, and that's not what we want today. You're a bit of a Renaissance man, because you are an author of, 20-some-odd books or thereabouts?
Sure. Yeah, I prefer dilettante to Renaissance man, but either works.
Dilettante.
Yeah, I've written a lot of books. They range from picture books for little kids to graphic novels for middle-grade readers, to adult works on policy at book length, to novels for adults, novels for young adults, short story collections, collections of essays, books on economic theory. I do run quite a gambit, as I say, dilettante.
Yes, and so there's sort of an intersection there, because you do you write a lot of science fiction, and you mm-hmm. deal with the tech world. So there's an overlap there. There's also another overlap in that I saw a quote somewhere in some of your writings. It said technology and politics are inseparable. Are they?
Yeah. I mean, we spend a lot of time talking about what technology does and not nearly enough time talking about who it does it for and who it does it to. And, you know, this comes up all the time when we think about technology in a kind of a unitary way without integrating politics. It can go really weird. Like in France, they're cracking down on Google's monopoly on the ad tech market. And Google really does have a very dirty monopoly on the ad tech market, where they run the sell side and the buy side, and they game it, and they basically like do a lot of wage theft from online creators. And so, you know, it's nice to see a regulator weighing in. But one of the things they want to do is make it easier for other companies to compete with Google on targeting by forcing Google to share more of our personal data more widely.
Great.
Right? So like, you know, if you don't consider who they're doing it for and who they're doing it to, this sounds like a perfectly reasonable thing. I'm a competition advocate and I like interoperability, but we don't want interoperability in everything. Like, we don't want competition to see like who can most efficiently violate our human rights, right?
No, no.
We don't want the race to build the world's most efficient data extraction machine. And so, you know, unless you stick politics in your technology and your economics, you end up with this kind of blind questing towards efficiency in things that we actually want to make harder. There's an old, you know, trope in science fiction that when people express their anxiety about artificial intelligence, what they really are expressing anxiety about is corporations, right? The shareholder maximization without any ethics just produces like a kind of sorcerer's apprentice dystopia where the machine grinds on and grinds us, you know?
Right. And doesn't it?
Well, I think it does. I mean, I'm not someone who says that we should never use markets to solve mm-hmm. anything, but there's an economist, John T. Harvey, who says that that if you think that markets are the only thing that you can use to solve complex problems, you're like a carpenter who thinks that screwdrivers are the only thing you can use to join one thing to another. And, you know, when someone comes along and says, you probably need to nail those things together, you're like, a hammer, what are you, a communist? You know, so I'm all for lots of different structures to get stuff done. You know, there's a limit. You were talking about being a sole practitioner. I'm mostly a sole practitioner. Mm-hmm. I'm keenly aware that while one person can do a lot, that groups of people are needed to do some very ambitious things that one person can't do at all. And whatever structure we can use to make that happen, you know, I'm okay with it a priori, but I think that those structures need to be regulated in service to the goal of human thriving, that the point of a company is to make human life better. The point of human life isn't to make the company better.
Wow.
And so unless we can balance that.
That right there is a great point to sort of jump off on, because mm-hmm. When I first contacted you, it was about a month ago. I had just read on your blog, which is at pluralistic.net, mm-hmm. a piece about you wrote how copyright filters lead to wage theft. And at the time, I had just been recently suspended from streaming on YouTube for the second mm-hmm. time. And not because I did anything horrible. What happened was they have these, I guess, bots that go through and comb the web and comb YouTube for, oh my God, a clip of a song. Now, it used to be in the old days that I think the rules, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, if I have that, the DMCA, is confusing, right? And it had these rules. And I thought in the beginning, you could get away with 30 seconds of a song. Because in the back then, nobody seemed to bother me when I'd play 30 seconds of a song to punctuate a news story or something. They didn't mm-hmm. then bother you. So I've been doing this for a long time. I come from the world of music radio, actually terrestrial radio before the internet. Mm-hmm. I'm old. And but I've been doing this online for over 10 years. And so I've got shows just archived on YouTube. Well, just yesterday alone, I got three notices from YouTube. One video was blocked from, let's see if I can find it. It was from like 2010 or something. And I got two copyright claims, and we'll get into this in a second. One from a show from November of 2019 and one from January of 2015. The thing I got blocked for, that I got suspended for, was a show from 2015 in which a feature that I played used bumper music that happened to be from Don Henley. And 6 years later, they come after me and say, not only, you know, are we blocking the video, you're suspended from live streaming for 90 days.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't even tell you what the offense was. So I actually, you know, I have audio podcasts too. So I went back and listened to the show. And the minute I heard Henley, I knew that was it, because he's notorious for this. And that's what got me suspended the first time. But this is an abuse of power, as far as I'm concerned. Am I like way off base here?
Yeah, I think you've got the right shape of things. There are some particulars that I think are technical and in the realm of copyright and kind of complicated. But what the DMCA says is that the people who host content are not liable for copyright infringement if, when they're told that there's an infringement, they remove the stuff. It's called expeditiously, just uh-huh. quickly,
okay.
right? So what that means is that if you are YouTube and you get a notice from a rights holder that says this infringes my copyright, you get to make some determinations, right? You can look at the work and you can say, I don't think it infringes copyright. I think that's fair use,
right?
That's fair use is not 30 seconds. It's actually a really complicated analysis that you need a human who understands the law for, because like fair use creates exemptions for things like parody and criticism.
Yes.
No one's ever invented a computer that can tell parody and criticism from verbatim reproduction. It also asks that you do things like evaluate whether or not you're going to undermine the market for the underlying work. It asks whether the use is proportionate, whether you've taken more than you need. These aren't things that software can evaluate, right? These are things that you really need a complex human evaluation. And fair use is really important. In there were a couple of landmark Supreme Court copyright cases in the first part of the century where the court took up the question of the intersection between copyright and free speech. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you know your First Amendment, you know, it starts Congress shall make no law. And it says Congress shall make no law regarding restrictions on speech, on expression. Mm-hmm. And so then you have this other thing, copyright, which is also in the Constitution. It's in something called the Progress Clause. To promote the progress of the useful arts and sciences, Congress may grant monopolies of limited times, right? And copyright is the government making a law that says that some words can't be repeated unless you get permission from someone else, right? And so this is a kind of a, it's, there are two priorities that are in tension. Now, look, I make my living from books. I'm not going to say that we don't need any copyright. Right. I like the idea of copyright as a set of regulations for the supply chain of my industry.
Of course.
I think it's kind of silly to ask, you know, a 12-year-old who wants to put up some Harry Potter fanfic to navigate industrial regulation. Like, I like finance regulation, but I wouldn't ask, you know, parents to file with the SEC when they give their kids allowance either, right? Like, you know, the most important thing about regulation is actually not what the rules say. It's who you apply them to. You know, parents paying out allowance are not banks. Kids posting Harry Potter fanfic are not in the entertainment industry. You know, like, as someone who wants my industry to be a well-regulated and fair one, I want to make sure that the rules are crafted so that they have the complexity and nuance to capture those industrial relations. You can't make them simple enough for a 12-year-old to understand if you're also going to make them suited for my purpose. So anyway, that's like by way of background. So the Supreme Court took this up and they said, look, resolving this tension between free speech and copyright and the exclusive rights of authors is captured by fair use. The fair use isn't like a nice to have. Fair use, the judges, they called it the escape valve for free expression that allows commentary, criticism, all kinds of things. And, you know, yeah, they implicate judges. You need people to make subtle legal defenses. But, you know, just because they're hard to figure out, it doesn't make them irrelevant. And actually, the reason they're hard to figure out is they're so important. You know, so for example, an author, a Black woman, took Gone with the Wind and rewrote it from the perspective of the enslaved people. She called it The Wind Ungone.
Wow. I'd love to read
that. The Mitchell estate sued her and she won. The Supreme Court found in her favor, even though she took the whole book, even though she took the heart of the book, even though she competed directly commercially with them, and even though she made a commercial use of it, the Supreme Court found that the free expression value of her use trumped all of those other factors in the fair use analysis. Great. So when you then turn a computer loose to make determinations about fair use, right, to say, well, is that 10 seconds or 30 seconds? Is it too much? Is it too little? Is it critical? Is it scholarly? Is it parodical? You end up annihilating, incinerating all of the free speech questions. Mm. Now, it gets more complicated when you talk about YouTube because YouTube isn't applying the DMCA. What happened was that YouTube was sued by Viacom over a copyright infringement.
That's the takedown that I got yesterday.
Was from
Viacom. But they didn't give me a copyright strike. They just took down the video, which is fine.
So they negotiated a private side deal, basically, with Viacom and the other rights holders. After they won in court, but they negotiated this private side deal where they said, we're just going to spend $100 million building this system called Content ID. And Content ID is a private contract between the rights holders and YouTube that sets out things like demonetization, removal, strikes and strike anti-strikes and all the rest of it. So we're not talking about the law here. We're talking about a contractual arrangement. And when you click through the garbage novella of legalese that has an I agree box at the bottom when you create your YouTube account, you've agreed to be bound by the terms of this contract between YouTube and these third parties. Right now, this would not be as big a deal if it weren't for the fact that YouTube is the only game in town. Right. There might be someone out there who might say, like, and you see this, you know, with the far right, you see that there are some platforms popping up that say, we are going to put our thumbs on the scales of trusting our users. We will notionally, I guess, invest in moderators to investigate claims and so on. I don't think they do a good job of it. But, you know, the idea that, like, if you are targeted by bad faith actors who take down your material, or if you're like a piano teacher
who
teaches
who you wrote
Brahms,
about. Yes.
You know, and Sony owns all the masters to all the classic performances, and they upload those. And if you perform Brahms well, the software, I mean, it's your copy, right? You made it, you recorded it, you fixed it in a medium. That performance belongs to you, but the software will never be able to determine the difference. And if they make it sensitive enough to determine the difference, you can just take a Sony recording and tweak it a little and it will escape the filter. And so YouTube wants to keep Sony happy. So they turn the dial all towards... a hair trigger instead of forbearance. Right. But maybe someone out there wants to say, okay, I'm going to create a platform for music teachers, right? And I'm going to invest in the moderators to make sure that those music teachers aren't uploading Sony things. And I'm going to, you know, I'll put a circuit breaker in. I hear from Sony, a musicologist goes and looks at it, right? That would be great. But those market entrants aren't arriving. And the reason they're not arriving, and I talked about competition before, is that Google has cornered markets. They have cornered the market for the content distribution side. Mm-hmm. They've cornered the market for the display advertising. They've cornered the market for the search and so on. And they've effectively excluded people from that mainstream of video stuff there. Vimeo has pivoted to doing corporate video. So Vimeo's current like main bread and butter is like, if you do training videos for your franchise business, Vimeo is going to host them for you.
Right.
That you have specialist platforms like Patreon and so on. But
it's not mass. It's not for the masses. Yeah. YouTube is the only game in town. You know, you wrote about this, a woman named Marina, the piano teacher, who published her free lessons on YouTube, and she quit on her fifth anniversary because you wrote, quote, her meager wages were being stolen by fraudsters. So that's the other part. You mentioned content ID. So there's the one part where they'll just take you down and give you a copyright strike and still not tell you what your offending content was. But then there's this content ID. And I get these every day, and not from the show I'm doing today. I'll get one from 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 years ago saying, you know, your content ID matched this publishing company. So they're taking, it's not a copyright strike, but they're going to take whatever revenue you earn from that video. Yeah. Right. And the thing is, they don't even tell you what the offending clip was. So you have no recourse.
So the Marina story is interesting because it made such a stink that YouTube actually had a human being go and look and say, oh, no, this is BS, and give her back her money. And she said she would go back to the platform. And what was interesting is that after I published that article, a bunch of or a small number of very vocal advocates for filters whose view on filters is that the reason they don't work very well is that the nerds aren't nerding hard enough, right? That like it could work and it just doesn't because the YouTube's heart isn't in it. Right. Those people said, well, look, the system works. Marina is back. Right. Well, there is an appeals process. And the thing is, they're right to the extent that anytime you have a large firm that has high-handed policies and no way to reach a human being to appeal them, national news, sometimes that firm will sit up and go, oh, you're right. Right. You get this with things like, I don't know, Gwyneth Paltrow's exploding candles, right? You know, if you send Gwyneth Paltrow an email saying your candle exploded, you know, you'll get an email back saying you clicked through the garbage novella of legalese that said, I agree that I won't get a refund if my candle explodes. But if you make national news, they'll send you a check and maybe like some extra ones, right?
Right.
It's like police shootings, right? Like if you get shot by the cops, generally you have no recourse, right? But if you're
someone
national news
it, yes,
and you're the 100th guy, eventually Derek Chauvin will be convicted, right? But that doesn't mean the system works. It means the system doesn't work.
Right. No, it doesn't work. Sorry, my husband came in and he had an issue as well. That, but yeah, it happens all the time. I mean, he got booted off of LinkedIn for whatever, and they don't tell him. He got booted off of, you know, he's one who sometimes tweets before he thinks, but they don't tell you. They don't give you any recourse. But in this case, with the, you know, they're taking revenue and you have no recourse. This is not part of the DMCA, though.
It's the private arrangement. So, you know, like this is the point at which people will say, well, look, it's house rules. If you don't like the rules, don't go into their house. And there's a point to that, right? That censorship is generally construed as state action, although that's a very narrow construction. You know, in the during the Inquisitions, the church did the book burning. The state didn't. And, you know, the state was like a separate entity from the church. I mean, there were established churches, but it wasn't the king's order. It was the bishop's order that burned your books. And it was still censorship. I think most people would say that, you know, the Inquisition is not an example of non-censorship because it was private action by a third party. And they're right. They're right that mostly when we think about free expression, we think about state action. We are particularly suspicious of things like must-carry rules. Like you're seeing some people on the right moot for online platforms, or that new Florida bill that says that social media must give accounts to politicians.
Yeah,
and, you know, look, I have a blog. I don't want people telling me what I must put on my blog. Right,
but can I?
I get it.
But it's also so once I live in Florida. Sorry, the Florida. Right. And so Ron DeSantis pushes that law through, except in the case of Rebecca Jones, who got booted off of Twitter, and he's applauding that. Because,
yeah, I mean, this is the thing that I think the right fails to understand is that a strict interpretation of that would mean that you couldn't get rid of Antifa and Black Lives Matter activists on Parler, right?
That's right.
But that aside, imagine a thought experiment, right, where you live in a town where there's a bunch of different restaurants, and one that's doing really well is called No Politics at the Dinner Table. And they only have one rule. You're not allowed to talk politics at the dinner table. Right. The waiter catches you talking politics, they sling your butt out the door.
Good.
Right? So then No Politics raises a bunch of money from some private equity companies, and they buy all of their rivals. Mm-hmm. And if they won't sell, they underprice them so that they go out of business. Right? And then maybe they even go to the town council and they go like, hey, you know what? The restaurant business is dangerous. People die of foodborne illnesses. We think that the kitchen setup should require a lot of very expensive sanitary gear that we can afford, but that a new market entrant couldn't, right? Fast forward 6 or 7 months, and now you can't get restaurant zoning. If you can get zoned for a restaurant, they'll buy you out. If they don't buy you out, they'll predatory price you out of existence. They have most favored nation status with all of the local farmers. So they get their food cheaper than you. They clone your menu, right? And you can't talk politics at the dinner table anywhere in town. Now, the government never passed a rule saying no politics at the dinner table.
Right.
But the government's forbearance on regulating markets led to a circumstance in which they might as well have passed it. And the only difference is that if they had passed that rule, you would have standing to go to court and ask for a First Amendment judgment striking down the rule. But the forbearance in competition law means that you have no such remedy. Right. And so there's always going to be a speech policy in competition policy because markets implicate speech, right? If you have monopolies on transport, then you could have, as we had with the far right, you could have someone saying, we're not going to let anyone fly to this city where a big demonstration is planned. Now, I would be glad if the demonstrators who are kept away were opposed to the causes I believe in, as those January 6th demonstrators, the rioters were. You know, mm-hmm. I'm happy to see anything that stands in their way. But I'm also keenly aware that when that power has been exercised, it's mostly been exercised against people I agree with.
That's right.
You know, anti-pipeline activists, trans rights activists, anti-nuclear proliferation activists, civil rights workers. That's where you've seen the organized power of transport monopolies to restrict access to demonstrations. And when you see media concentration, there's obviously a dimension to it. But when you see telecommunications concentration, right? If someone says, well, we're going to cut off your internet. If you are doing something we don't like, which, you know, BART shut down the internet, the Bay Area Rapid Transit, the subway system in San Francisco, there was a big demonstration about police violence. They shut off the Wi-Fi.
Wow.
Right. Yes. So you couldn't stream the demonstration. So there's always going to be, in competition policy, there's always going to be a communications policy. And that isn't to say that communication should always trump competition, or competition should always trump communication. But it is to say that, like, when you regulate one or forbear from regulating one, you have to attend to the other. You have to think, well, in allowing this to happen, in allowing the idiotic merger of Sprint and T-Mobile, for example, what are the speech implications? Not the First Amendment implications, right? Because the First Amendment is narrow. But the First Amendment seeks to achieve a pluralistic place where different viewpoints can be heard, right? Where we can all of us access each other, form groups, express our will, try and win other people to our cause and so on. What is the speech implication for that merger? And when that doesn't get a look in, right? When we don't ask ourselves about the communications implications of competition policy, then communication suffers. Then the restaurant decisions become decisions about who can talk politics. And that's a real problem.
Right. Now, you've said that you believe copyright laws should be liberalized to allow for free sharing of all digital media. And in fact, I don't know if you still do.
That's a thing people say I said. Okay.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it's a little more nuanced.
Okay. But you did make your books available
Under Creative Commons, under which Creative sets Commons. Rules for digital sharing. It's not free sharing. It's
gotcha.
Rule-based sharing. Right.
So
right?
in other words, I can share my PDF of your book as long as I'm not making money off of it or capitalizing on it. Right.
Yeah. Most of the books, the last couple of my publisher has balked at. To be honest, it didn't make a difference in the sales. So maybe they'll reverse their
turns.
I mean, I've had books that were New York Times bestsellers and I've had books that flopped. They're not real. The license arrangement seems to be, irrelevant to that or at least not determinative of it. So, I'm not, but for me, it was just about establishing the idea that if you have to understand copyright to read a book,
right.
That's like having to understand finance law to spend money. Like that's crazy, right?
Right.
Like it brings the regulation that I need to form a framework for how I negotiate with my publisher, my editor, my agent, the booksellers and so on. It brings that whole enterprise into disrepute because it makes it seem like nonsense, right?
Right. It's, right.
If you have to understand all this business about fair use to write Harry Potter fanfic, that's bananas, right? Like it's just tell that to a parent of a 12-year-old and they'll tell you that your rule is stupid and no one should pay attention to it. And I don't want that, right? I want people to pay attention to that rule so that we can make it better so that I can use it to extract higher value for my creative labor from the other actors in my value chain.
Cory Doctorow is with us, and I screwed up by not allotting a full hour to talk with you because we've barely even scratched the surface, and we're getting to the bottom of the hour. But I got to ask I said I come from terrestrial radio. I'm sort of spanning the two kinds of technologies, and I remember so clearly sitting in my apartment in 1995-96 in Santa Monica, getting notices from AFTRA, the union, saying they're looking at passing this thing, the Telecommunications Act of 1996, and everything's going to change. And sure enough.
Yeah.
Everything changed.
It really did.
And it has not been updated since then, but it destroyed my industry of radio that I love, that I've worked in since, not too long after you were born. So,
well, right? 71, yeah.
79. So, since 1979,
oh, right. Well,
I've been in radio. And my industry doesn't exist anymore. It's been destroyed. And it's because of regulations. And talking about, the Supreme Court just unanimously did away with the local ownership rules. They should have been brought back to where they were pre-Telecommunications Act. And instead they said, no limits. One company can own two newspapers, two television, eight radio stations in a market. It's okay. Well, it's not okay.
And to be fair, that wasn't just regulation. It was the lack of it, right?
Right
so it's,
right.
The, it's the forbearance of regulation, the lack of merger scrutiny. So the history of radio is very interesting because, when the first sheet music came out, that the only people who had a music industry were people who wrote songs because performing a song was not an industry. It was a craft.
Mm-hmm.
To be an industry, it has to have reproduction, right? And so when performers became an industry as well through recording, the sheet music publishers said, what do you think you're doing? You're stealing our work. You're not creators. You are trained monkeys who perform the instructions that we write down on sheet music. John Philip Sousa went to Congress and said, if these infernal machines, these talking machines are allowed to continue, we'll lose our voice boxes as we lost our tails when we came down out of the trees. So what you got was a compulsory license, the mechanical license that allows anyone to record any song once it's been released as a recording. That's how Sid Vicious recorded My Way. He didn't get Paul Anka's permission. He just paid the statutory license fee. And then along came radio, right? And started taking these phonograms and putting them on the radio.
Yeah.
And the phonogram producers said, what are you doing? When we took that sheet music, that was progress. When you play our records, that's theft, right?
We're selling records for you.
Right. So they boycotted radio. So they formed ASCAP. ASCAP mm-hmm. boycotted radio, but ASCAP also boycotted poor people and black people. They wouldn't let country music and blues into ASCAP.
Wow.
And so the excluded groups of musicians, the disfavored groups of musicians, formed their own royalty society called BMI.
Right.
And BMI licensed music for radio. And this is how what was called hillbilly music and race music, which we now call R&B or blues and country music, became the mainstream music of America because all of the legitimate music was being kept off the air by ASCAP. And ASCAP folded and said, fine, we'll put our music on the radio too. And so that's how we got music on the radio. Now, you know, from terrestrial days, if you're going to drop the needle on a record, you don't call up the company and ask them how much you're going to pay.
No.
You're covered by a blanket license.
That's right.
And that's not a thing that we have for the internet.
No, exactly. And that's why I would love to do a hybrid, you know, news, politics, music show, because that's where I am. And I can't play the music. And it kind of kills me.
And there's a lot of musicologists who just like to ply their trade.
Yeah.
Right. To just do scholarship of the sort that has existed for as long as music has existed. And they're excluded from the digital realm almost altogether because of automated enforcement. And so, you know, like, blanket licenses wouldn't solve all of our problems. There's some artists who do very well by selling per play. Bandcamp is a really good example of it. But, you know, if we had a rule, for example, that if anyone could get a streaming license, right, once it was on Spotify, just like you can't, you don't have a compulsory license to record a song until someone has recorded it. We could say you don't have a compulsory license to stream a song until someone's streaming it. But then we could level the playing field. You know, Spotify's major a competitive advantage is they have an army of guys in well-tailored suits who go out and strike license deals for them. And that becomes a very sturdy barrier. Well, it's not to the advantage of musicians to have all of their music locked up in one intermediary silo.
Right.
It would, you know, because then it just gives the Spotify the negotiating leverage to put the screws to them. We know that that's what happens with intermediaries. You know, everyone since John D. Rockefeller seized the oil fields, we have known what happens when you have an intermediary that sits between producers and consumers. The intermediary starts to siphon off more value for themselves. And where you have a disorganized intermediary sector, we have lots and lots of different ways to stream music. It's hard for them to collude to screw the artists. And so this is an opportunity, you know, to revisit the way that we deal with creative labor and fair compensation, because, you know, artists don't get fairly compensated for their work, but it's not
true
merely because the streaming royalties are too low. It's because Universal, when it was co-owner of Spotify, agreed to a lower streaming royalty. Mm-hmm. Because that meant that it got more profits and it had to share the royalties with its artists,
right,
but it could give its profits straight to its shareholders. And so if we could diversify that sector, set it against each other so that there were 1,000 music companies fighting each other for musicians' business instead of 3 who could easily collude, then it would be better on average for musicians. And we could still retain those independent platforms like Bandcamp that don't do that kind of blanket streaming, that were sui generis for the kind of artists that are making a living by directly connecting with their fans,
sure,
and not mainstream pop acts. We could have the best of both worlds. We could have nice things.
We could.
And it requires that we address the monopoly problem. And, you know, I know we're out of time, but I'll say that I happen to know that the Senate is about to drop 5 anti-monopoly bills regulating tech.
Really? Oh, well, that's huge.
I have read them and commented on them, as have many allies. And I think they are, by and large, very good bills. And they have bipartisan support.
Wow.
And so we are seeing movement for a reinvigorated muscular antitrust that has not been seen in this country in a century. And it's a watershed moment. And, you know, if you're angry that your favorite wrestler is begging on GoFundMe for pennies to pay for their medical bills, the reason they're doing it is because Vince McMahon bought all the other wrestling leagues and reclassified his employees as contractors and took away their health care.
Wow.
And if you're angry that you couldn't get a vaccine until too late, it's because one company makes all the glass bottles in America. And if you're angry that your glasses are 1,000% more expensive than they were 10 years ago,
company.
It's because one company owns every eyewear brand,
yep,
and every eyewear retailer,
yep,
and the largest lens maker in the world.
Yes.
And if you're angry that there's only 2 beer companies or 4 giant banks that always seem to get their way, you're angry about monopoly. And so, you know, we have a common foe here.
Yeah, we do.
And if we understand that when they're fighting tech monopolies, that it's the first domino to fighting entertainment monopolies and finance monopolies and oil monopolies and all the other monopolies that distort our lives, then we have the beginning of a new kind of country, a country organized around collective human thriving and not siphoning off of value for a tiny number of people, where companies are organized for human benefit, where human lives aren't rearranged for corporate benefit.
I'm getting goosebumps because you're talking my language here. This is my utopia, and that's what we need to strive for. It seems insurmountable with all the other shit that's going on in D.C. and the nonsense that's being spewed from the right and the insanity from Trump world. But these are the things that we need to do to get on the right track. Anyway, Cory Doctorow, I hope you will come back because I would love to continue this conversation with you. This is awesome.
I'd love to.
And I want to hear more about these anti-monopoly bills. I think you've read David Dayan's book, Monopolized. This is right, the kind of stuff
We just did an online event together.
Oh, good. Good. Yeah. David's a regular guest.
We just did an online event together, me and David.
Oh, at American Prospect. Yes, he's great. And the book is great. Awesome. Cory, I'm going to be back in touch. I'm honored that you came here. My head is spinning from all the things you said. I wish I didn't have to go.
My pleasure.
But I look forward to talking with you again. Thank you so much. Cory Doctorow, everybody.
Okay. Thank you. Talk to you later.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. What a treat that was. And, I love Howie Klein. And if I had given Howie any notice, I would have brought him in here. Because, Howie was president of Reprise Records. That's how I know Howie Klein. So he's dealt with this issue as well. In fact, speaking of Howie Klein, I'm running late. And where is my Howie open? Hold on. I know I've got it down here. Ah! Wrong button. I didn't pull up the right window. Oh, no. Come on. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. He's at number 5, I believe. This is when I'm not prepared. Hold on. Come on, Howie. Where are you? There we are. Okay, let's get Howie on the line, shall we?
Are you a multinational corporation hungry for a treat? Well, come on down to Schmucky Chucky's, where you'll personally be seated by Chuck Schumer himself.
So many dishes, and they're all fresh.
You're gonna love our Blue Dog special, the Dino Burger, because we say so.
A good hamburger and French fries.
And every burger comes with a side order of...
grits. I love grits. I love anything with corn. It's corn.
All for only $50,000. Wash it all down with a Dirty Debbie.
9/10 water, 1/10 orange juice. After a week or two, you drink this, it's 200 calories and it's acidic.
And wipe your mouth with a tissue print of Glass-Steagall. For dessert, try our DNC tarts.
Little cookies, tell the quality of that.
Most restaurants give you a mint, but at Schmucky Chucky's, you get complimentary.
Sweet and low.
Who picks up the tab for all this? Find out now with Howie Klein of DownWithTyranny.com on The Nicole Sandler Show.
Wrong mic. Hey, Howie Klein.
Nicole Sandler, how are you today?
I'm okay. How are you doing?
Great. Doing good.
Good.
Just finishing up a post, so I'm happy.
Ah, okay.
Finish a post.
Good. All right. I want to hear about it in a second, but I got to tell you, I just had the most fascinating conversation with Cory Doctorow. Are you familiar with him?
Of course.
Right.
Tell me.
Oh, my God. Well, I had read something, and I think you told me about him years ago, but I read something by him last month about copyright and about this woman who was a piano teacher who used to post her lessons on YouTube, and she got copyright violated for posting one of her Brahms lessons. And that's bullshit because it's in the public domain, and it's the kind of crap that I've been dealing with, except worse because, when I inadvertently air 20 seconds of a song, it's not in the public domain. But that aside, it piqued my interest, and I sent him an email, and we had a lovely back and forth, and he agreed to come on the show, and today was the day. And I just didn't want to spring it on you. I almost said, asked him to stay and brought you in because we were talking about, the problem with music, and you being the former president of Reprise Records, I'm sure you had your run-ins with copyright issues in the record business, did you?
Yes. I don't know if I ever told you or not, but before I was the president of Reprise, before that I worked for Sorry, but earlier I had my own record label called 415, an independent label.
Yes.
I actually own some music copyrights, and at one point I was making YouTubes, and I had done, I don't know, something between 100 and 200 YouTubes just for fun and using my own music that I own, and all of a sudden YouTube disabled the entire, let's call it 150, it's probably closer to 200. They disabled the entire account and said, I'm not welcome to use YouTube anymore.
Oh,
and there was
God.
No one to appeal to.
Right.
I mean, I kept trying to find someone to listen to me. And I mean, I guess you can do it if you get a lawyer to go for it. But I just decided to stop using YouTube.
Wow.
I've never made another video since then. I mean, they destroyed almost 200 videos.
That's incredible. And I should have just brought you in with Corey on the line, because this is exactly what we were talking about. We are in this weird limbo section of history, I think, between the old days of, pre-internet and today, when everything is moving from terrestrial media to the internet, and the regulations either haven't caught up, or they're overly regulated, or as Corey put it, they're owned by so few voices who own everything, and they, all just want to make money off of it all and screw the little guy. But, your story's worse than mine.
I'm very frustrated. I think just regular people are just very frustrated that there's no way to get to them.
Right.
I mean, this has nothing to do with music. I recently put up a gate in front of my driveway. I leave the door and the gate open. Anyone can come in or out. I don't lock it.
Right.
That's not what the gate is for. And yet now I'm petrified to order something from Amazon. You can't talk to them. I mean, the other day I ordered two large cartons of water.
Okay.
And the guy just threw them over the fence. I mean, he could have just walked like he would normally. If there was no gate, he could have done the same thing he would always do and just walked over to the front door and leave them. But instead, he just threw them over the fence, breaking them, and the water got all over the place. There's no one for me to appeal to.
Oh, I'll give you a phone number.
We
have a phone number.
No luck. You can't get anything out of them. You can't get a response out of them. And another guy, threw a bottle, a bottle of vitamins over the fence. Sound like some disgruntled old Trump fan.
Karen Kent
threw a bottle of vitamins over the fence, and it landed in the sun and got, it was ruined.
Right. Well, I'll have to give you the phone number, because David, my husband, is the master dealing with Amazon, because we have those issues as well. And there is a number to get to a human being. So I'll make sure you get that.
I looked.
Oh, no,
yes,
we got it. You got it.
You should tell the whole, all your listeners as well. I'm sure I'm not the only one that has this
No,
problem.
You're right. Okay, well, if David can, he's probably working out right now, but he'll bring in the number and I will share it, because he calls them every day. He's on the phone with them all the time. And we used Amazon a lot during the, the lockdown period. We still do, but because it's there. But the thing with YouTube, you can't get through to a human being. Somehow they did away
these
with
my, these were my copyrights.
I know.
It wasn't like I was using somebody else's stuff. They dinged me for using my own stuff.
That's crazy. Well, Dan Navarro from Lohan and Navarro, he during the lockdown was doing a live stream every day playing his own songs, and he would get copyright violations on them. It's ridiculous. Leland Sklar, the amazing bass player, does a live thing every day and is constantly getting harassed by YouTube for his own songs, for playing the bass line that he played on the songs that he's on the record. And it doesn't matter. Something's got to give here. So that's one of the things that, that we were talking about. All right, here comes David. This is the phone number. 877 252.
I'm not anywhere to write it down.
All right, I'll email it to
definitely
you.
Definitely, everybody should get a pen and paper now,
right,
and write this down.
It's 877.
This is a deal with Amazon,
this
right?
This is for Amazon. If you need to get through to a human being at Amazon, 877-252-2701, and you press option number 1, and that will get you a human being. You can actually speak with a human being.
Amazing. I didn't even know that they even have any human beings who work at Amazon.
Right. Yeah, David said it's not always a competent human being, and certainly not always one who speaks English well, but you will get a human being on that number.
Got it.
So.
And since I'm in the kitchen and my hands are full, can you email
I will email it to you, absolutely. So I figured you had stories like that, but it is frustrating. And the other part is YouTube has this automated thing that this is what they do. It's called Content ID. And that's why I was telling him, I got 3 emails yesterday of these Content IDs. They're not copyright violations, but somebody has claimed that something I played in my show in that 1 or 2 hour period that they don't identify is owned by this other party. And therefore they will take all the revenue that was earned on that show by that stream. I have no way to appeal it, number one. No way to even know what content they're talking about. This is a problem. But what Cory Doctorow was saying is, he said there's about five anti-monopoly bills that are going through that will be passed by the Senate. He said he's read them, he's seen them, and it will make things a whole lot better. Not necessarily with YouTube and this, what we're talking about, but breaking up some of these monopolies who have a monopoly over our lives.
Oh, good. I'm so glad to hear that. I mean, I know a lot of people who are working on that, but I didn't know that that anything was going to actually pass.
Nor did I. And I told him, you know,
surprised because these people spend so much money on lobbyists and on bribing members of Congress.
Yeah. Well, that's what they do. So anyway, he promised, he said he'd come back on the show. I'm going to allot a whole hour because he can talk. I could just sit back and listen to him. He's got so much information, and I want to find out more about those anti-monopoly laws. This, you know, the Antitrust Act hasn't been acted on. We are a country of monopolies, so there's that.
Yes.
Anyway,
you know, there's a couple of people who you might want to also talk to.
Yeah.
About that. I mean, you know, Doctorow is as good as you're going to get.
Yeah.
But a friend of mine who also wrote a book about it and is really active, and that's his whole life right now, his whole professional life, is antitrust, is Matt Stoller. Do you know him at all?
You know, I know who he is, of course, but I've never met Matt Stoller.
I'll introduce you to Matt Stoller by email.
I would love that.
And then another one who I met through Matt Stoller is this guy who's running for the Senate from Missouri, Lucas Kuntz. And Lucas... also, or Kuntz, I think.
I was going to say that's an unfortunate last name.
No, it's Kuntz. So, so Lucas is also, you know, that's his thing as well, is antitrust.
Uh-huh.
So you might want to meet. Maybe I can introduce you, and you can actually interview him.
I would love
and
that.
You could talk about
the Senate race,
antitrust
too,
and his campaign for the U.S. Senate. He's, by the way, a candidate that Blue America has endorsed.
Oh, great. Okay. Oh, I'd love that. That'd be awesome. I look forward to that. So so what was your post that you just finished writing about?
Oh, it's for tomorrow. And it's a post about a woman who is running for the state assembly. So, we don't often endorse in state assembly races. We do a few, but not many. And usually we're looking for someone who's not just going to be a good assembly member. I mean, we want that, but we're looking for someone who is going to be on the bench and become someone important at the minimum in their community. But you know, perhaps go on to be president, or if not president, senator, or congressman, you know, or governor.
Uh-huh.
And when we see that kind of trait in someone, That's when we wind up endorsing in those local state legislative races. And this woman, she's only 29 years old.
Wow.
Although she looks and seems even younger, but she is 29, and she just sort of oozes that kind of great spirit and, you know, progressive, fiery power. And I just, you know, talking to her, it just made me think that she is going to she's going to be someone who will remember for a very long time. And I'm sure everyone wants to know her name.
Yeah.
And it's Janani, so J-A-N-A-N-I, Janani. And then her last name is Ramachandran.
Wow.
So Ramachandran.
Okay. And where is this?
It's in the East Bay. Oakland. Most of the district is in Oakland, but also in San Leandro and Alameda. And she's running for the seat that was vacated by Rob Bonta when he was appointed Attorney General. And Bonta wasn't bad.
Okay.
He was an okay, you know, liberal establishment guy. He didn't do anything. He certainly wasn't like a fighter. He was just there and voted right, and he was okay. You know, no complaints about him, unless you expect more from your representatives. But it's good enough that they're just not doing terrible things. Usually.
Yeah, like, you know, how's this for a segue? What about Merrick Garland?
Yeah, well, I mean, I said that when Obama
yes.
first said he would be he wanted to put him on the Supreme Court. I thought, oh God, you know, why not find like the worst possible Democrat that you could find? And he was looking for someone who the Republicans would like.
Yes.
And that's why he picked him to
exactly.
begin with. And the Republicans didn't like him enough to let it come to a vote. But they it wasn't a joke when everybody was saying he's one of them.
Yes,
he is.
He is.
He's a total establishment guy, was from the beginning, and that's why Obama picked him.
Right. So then why the hell did Joe Biden pick him? Did he think that was going to be a fuck you to Mitch McConnell? Because Mitch McConnell probably laughed all the way to the...
Biden is also a conservative Democrat. He has been his whole career. And it would make sense that he would do that. And, you know, maybe he felt he owed it to Obama. Maybe he was emotionally invested in the... In that nomination from the beginning, you know, could have been his idea to nominate this guy. Who knows? I don't know why, but it's not. There's nothing about Garland that would make you think that he wouldn't be a pick from Biden. Sorry.
Right. Well, conservatively, I mean, just yesterday, it was like three stories, one on top of another, of the things that he's defending, from, you know, Donald Trump defaming E. Jean Carroll. Sorry, that was not part of his presidential duties. And for him to construe it that way, I find insulting. Then and somebody had a different take on this than I did, and I didn't have a chance to read it. But the defending the religious school exemption for LGBTQ students really pissed me off. But somebody pointed out, if it's not the Justice Department doing it, then this other entity would then get control of doing it. It would be even worse. I'm sorry. That's the definition of the lesser of two evils. That's not okay. This exemption has to be gone. And if Biden's not going to, advocate for that, then what good is he?
Well, no good. But Biden has said he's not going to interfere with the Justice Department.
I know. I know. It's fucked up. The other big story you have a post on from yesterday, your headline is America's Hereditary Plutocracy. And it's the story that ProPublica broke about how the richest Americans are paying virtually nothing in federal income tax. And Merrick Garland's Justice Department said, we're going to go after whoever leaked that from the IRS.
Right. That was the point of my story. Is that you would think that the story was about leaks,
yes,
rather than about the fact that the richest people in America aren't paying any taxes.
Anything. Right. It's astounding. Okay, so this tells me two things. One is we need to change the fucking laws so that the people who are sitting on hundreds of billions of dollars have to pay their fair share in taxes, number one. And it's that what they're doing should not be legal. That's one problem. Then if you want to go after leakers, that's another story. But to me, the bigger problem is these people, you know, riding off of our hard work and our tax dollars when they're sitting on billions.
Yeah, well, of course, that's the real tragedy here. And the fact that the American people overwhelmingly think that the rich should pay their fair share in taxes and want to see the tax rates go up, and yet it doesn't happen. Why doesn't it happen? Because voters don't seem to connect what they want and what their legislators are doing and think about, you know, maybe I'll vote against these people. But these big rich donors. I mean, if you looked at the names of the people, a lot of them are very, very rich Democratic donors, but mm-hmm. both Republicans and Democrats, but plenty of them are Democratic donors, like Bloomberg, and the people in Congress don't want to offend them. So that's why they won't even raise the corporate tax rate to where it was when Trump came into office.
Right.
He knocked it down from, I think, 36 to 21. So Biden said, let's put it up to 28,
yep.
Which seemed, you know, I was horrified by that.
And
how about put it up to 40?
Yeah, really?
But no, let's put it up to 20. And then he compromised with not even with Republicans, but with conservative Democrats, all right, 28 is too high. Let's go for 25.
But
and then the Republicans come in and said, no, how about if we go for nothing?
Right. And then Biden says, okay, well, then let's look at it differently. Let's put in a 15% minimum corporate tax, because even when it was 28 or 34, 31, whatever it was, those corporations still were using the loopholes to get around it and still not paying anything. What if there was a minimum 15% corporate tax rate where no matter what, you know, loopholes they try to crawl through, that's the bottom? Would that help?
Oh yeah,
so that
it would help. It's not.
It's not good enough. Not good enough.
But
I agree. Yeah. So
I mean, Mitch McConnell said he will veto, and because of Joe Manchin, Mitch McConnell has a veto. He will veto any tax increase. Period.
Unbelievable. I mean, it's totally believable. I say the word unbelievable all the time, but it's completely believable.
I meant to say Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema.
Yes.
I don't want to leave her out.
Right. No, and you can't. She's batshit fucking crazy, and you've been telling us this for years. She's got a new little coffee klatch, don't you know, with Deb Fischer and what's her name? Is it Kathleen Cortez Mastra, whatever, a couple of the, you know, Republican women who just love her because she won't be bowled over by those liberals. She's hanging, palling around with the Republican women in the Senate. And the problem is, you know, the Democrats have no majority. It's 50-50. And I'd gladly tell Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema to go hang with your buds over there. But then that gives us Mitch McConnell back as majority leader. And then we're really fucked.
Right. And that could happen.
That could happen like this.
The pressure on them is very, very, very slight. They don't want to put, you know, Biden and other Democrats, and Schumer mostly, don't want to put too much pressure on Manchin because he could just flip in a minute.
Yes.
Same with her.
That's right. It's walking on a tightrope. And so we have no recourse other than to win more Senate seats. And that has to wait until November of 2022. And who knows what could happen by then.
Not just win more Senate seats, because if you get another Kyrsten Sinema,
yeah,
or another Joe Manchin, what the hell good does it do? They're not going to do anything anyway.
Right.
I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to people in the audience. Don't vote for Schumer's choices.
Right.
Schumer picked Kyrsten Sinema.
That's
and
right.
Look at her now. Look
That's
at the
right.
problem we have with her now. He picked Jackie Rosen. Ugh, she's another
she's
one.
She's another one.
And said
Nevada.
Vote against the filibuster. She was a Schumer pick. All of his picks this year are terrible.
Yep.
In state after state after state, he's looking for people who will just follow orders and who are conservative and who he thinks can win Republican votes by being conservative. And they're all terrible. And that's who he wants. And he's just, you know, using all the power he has to undermine progressives who are running in those races.
Well, we saw it in the last cycle. We saw it in a perfect example, Colorado, where we could have had, what was his name? Andrew
Romanoff,
who was great. And instead we get Fracken Looper. Really?
Exactly.
Because he was Chuck Schumer's guy.
Or look at the ones that lost because they were terrible. I mean, in North Carolina, he picked this guy, Cal Cunningham, who obviously wasn't going to win, and just to keep Erica Smith out of it. I mean,
wow.
She was a distinguished state senator. She was leading in the polls, and Schumer thought, oh, my God, am I going to have this crazy Bernie-crat in Congress, in the Senate? And he pushed Cal Cunningham. They degraded her.
Right.
Cunningham won the primary and then lost the general election. And that's the normal footprint for Schumer. He will destroy the progressives, put in a conservative, and then doesn't care if the conservative wins or loses in the end. And that he did the same thing in Florida. Anything to make sure that Alan Grayson couldn't get the nomination, he put in an ex-Republican,
Patrick Murphy,
named Patrick Murphy, who was very, very conservative, blue dog, and really didn't have any chance to win. And he was beaten by Rubio.
Yeah, right.
And now Schumer's going to try to do the same thing
with Val Demings.
One of the most accomplished people in the entire Senate. She's being raved about. Schumer is behind this. She's being raved about by everybody. And you ask them, why are you raving about her? What has she done? And no one knows. They're
no,
just
she was an impeachment manager on the first impeachment.
All I know that she's done is that
she
as police chief, aside from having police, like, you know, beat up anyone who tried to feed homeless people, she went to a party and lost her gun.
Oh, my God. Yeah, no, I'm not really thrilled with our choices. And, here we go again. Oh, my God. All right, Howie Klein, we got our work cut out for us this time out. So in coming weeks, we will get some really good progressive candidates on this show. And remind everybody, primaries matter. It's the primary season where we have to make our voices heard because we need the progressive candidates to get the nominations, and then we take them to the general.
Exactly.
Thank you, Howie Klein.
Oh, okay.
We're
Thank
out
you.
Of time. I'll talk to you next week. All right.
Who knew?
All right. Bye-bye. Take care. All right. There's Howie. And that does it for us for today. I will leave you with, I promised, the news. I told you it was a busy show for you today. This was a day I could have used 2 hours. I should have kept Howie on and kept Cory Doctorow. Oh, well, next time. All right. Okay. Well, now let me leave you with the news, okay? All right. I'll see you tomorrow, everyone. Bye.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
President Biden arrived in Europe on Wednesday for the start of his first overseas trip since taking office. He told American troops in the UK that the future of the world would hinge on restoring America's frayed ties with its European allies.
I'm heading to the G7, then to the NATO ministerial, and then to meet with Mr. Putin to let him know what I want him to know. And at every point along the way, we're going to make it clear that the United States is back and democracies of the world are standing together to tackle the toughest challenges and the issues that matter most to our future. That we're committed to leading with strength, defending our values, and delivering for our people.
On Thursday, President Biden meets with UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson. They're expected to talk about lifting travel restrictions between the two countries in place to stop the spread of COVID-19. They're also expected to agree to a new Atlantic Charter, updating the historic declaration made by FDR and Winston Churchill. A new Pew Research Center global survey released Thursday confirms President Biden's assertion that
the United States is back.
In the 12 countries surveyed both this year and last, a median of 75% of respondents expressed confidence in Biden to, quote, do the right thing regarding world affairs. That's compared with 17% for Trump last year. 62% of respondents now have a favorable view of the United States versus 34% at the end of Trump's presidency. The Pew report reads, the election of Joe Biden as president has led to a dramatic shift in America's international image. Another report was issued on Wednesday, this one from the Interior Department's Inspector General regarding the clearing of protesters from Lafayette Park on June 1st of 2020. Remember that? Well, this report found that police forced protesters out of the park next to the White House so a contractor could install anti-scale security fencing, not so that then-President Trump could walk to a nearby church for a stage photo op holding up a Bible upside down. Oh, by the way, the Interior Department's Inspector General Mark Greenblatt was appointed by the former guy Donald Trump. Yeah, of course, that report was immediately followed by one of Trump's non-Twitter tweet-styled statements, which began, thank you to the Department of the Interior Inspector General for completely and totally exonerating me in the clearing of Lafayette Park. Yeah, not so fast. Here's CNN's Jim Acosta.
I was in the Rose Garden that day when Trump gave that speech and said, I'm going to go to this special place talking about the church. And you could hear the park police and other federal forces, D.C. police, clearing that park. They were violently pummeling protesters, tear gassing protesters. Remember at the time the White House was telling us, oh, we didn't use tear gas. The D.C. police were using tear gas. The other thing that is not clear about all of this is, you know, what did the White House team know at this time? According to the Inspector General's report, they did not speak to senior White House officials. They did not speak to the Secret Service. So this certainly raises more questions. And I have to say, you know, when I read through this report, it sounded as if this Inspector General was auditioning to become the Inspector General at Mar-a-Lago. Because, I mean, this is almost a whitewash of what occurred on June 1st. These protesters were largely demonstrating peacefully and were violently cleared from that park. It was just a huge blow to the First Amendment, I think, in this country. You can't have protesters pummeled by police officers when they're trying to make a statement about racial justice in this country.
Former White House counsel Don McGahn testified behind closed doors last week before the House Judiciary Committee. The transcript of that testimony was released on Wednesday, and it shed new light on the Mueller report. Judiciary Committee Chair Jerry Nadler said that Mr. McGahn provided the committee with substantial new evidence, including firsthand accounts of Trump's increasingly out-of-control behavior and insight into concerns that the former president's conduct could expose both Trump and McGahn to criminal liability. In a statement, Nadler also wrote, quote, Mr. McGahn also confirmed that President Trump lied when he denied the accuracy of the Mueller report and admitted that he was the source for a Washington Post report that confirmed Trump's direction to McGahn to remove the special counsel. Moving on, a big priority for U.S. officials right now in the fight against COVID-19 is getting people vaccinated, both at home and abroad. With that in mind, the Biden administration announced plans to donate 500 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine worldwide. At the same time, the U.S. vaccination rate is slowing. States are reporting that they have Johnson & Johnson vaccines set to expire before they'll get used. And Johnson & Johnson and federal officials are looking at whether the shelf life can be extended or if those doses can be put to other use. About 24 states have now scaled back their daily tracking of COVID-19 data. Some experts call the move premature, given the ongoing public health emergency and the risk of new variants. Well, this was a long time coming. After years of stops and starts, the Keystone XL pipeline is officially dead. The developer, TC Energy, announced Wednesday that it is pulling the plug on the controversial project after the Biden administration revoked its permit in January. The pipeline, which has been a political football for more than 10 years, would have carried oil from the tar sands of Canada down into the U.S. The news comes as a disappointment for many in the oil and gas industry, but for environmentalists who have long argued the pipeline would worsen the climate crisis, it is a big and long-awaited victory. But talks between President Biden and the Republican senators regarding infrastructure collapsed. So a new group of bipartisan House members on Wednesday unveiled a new $1.5 trillion infrastructure plan with $762 billion in new spending. It comes from the so-called Problem Solvers Caucus. And they've said they've been in touch with another group of so-called centrist senators who are discussing their own plans. But progressive Democrats say it's time to work on passing an infrastructure package without Republican support, if necessary. I think it's necessary. So yesterday we told you about the ProPublica report on the nation's wealthiest paying virtually nothing in federal income tax. Well, today we turn to Public Citizen, who also released a new report, this one called The Price of Zero, and it shows that at least 55 U.S. corporations avoided paying any corporate income tax in 2020 on a combined pre-tax income of $40.5 billion. The report notes, quote, had these companies paid a tax rate of 21%, the current federal rate, they would have owed the federal government $8.5 billion. Not only did these companies not pay taxes, but nearly all also got money back from the government, receiving $3.5 billion in tax rebates, bringing the total 2020 tax giveaway for these 55 companies to $12 billion. According to data obtained from the Center for Responsive Politics, instead of paying taxes, the companies invested a combined $408 million in lobbying and $42 million in campaign contributions over the past three election cycles. I got the news. And
that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.